Professor Alvarez, I think I'm just gonna begin, and I'll just begin again by saying thank you so much for joining us. I really took a fat chance by emailing you. I didn't think that you were gonna respond, let alone say that you are willing to chat to us. So we are humbled. We know we're just a bunch of random people on the other side of the planet, but we're very humbled that you are joining us. So thank you again.
It's my pleasure.
So, Professor Avivas, what I've done is, because I didn't expect you to say yes, I do not feel equipped to interview you on my on what I know about you. So, what I've done is I've asked a bunch of friends to send me their questions, and I'm going to just relay some of those questions and see if we can have a bit of an exchange on that, and then after that we can open it up to maybe some Q&A on this on the Zoom, if that's okay with you.
Sure.
Maybe just in terms of a time frame, I don't want to take advantage of a almost retired professor. So, how much time can we bargain
for? An hour.
An hour. Okay. Good. Perfect. We'll do that. So, Professor, I'll just jump in with a question from a good friend of ours, Tom Smith, who's a pastor and a theologian. And he asked the question, how do we develop virtues for the kingdom in the current lockdown? So maybe just with the added bit that says that your theology presupposes us imitating this in community. But now with this fractured community, how on earth do we, how do we do that?
I'm hesitant to do this, but let me blow my own horn a bit. There's a book that I published about a year and a half ago called The Character of Virtue, Letters to a Godson. When Sam and Joe Wells had their child, their first child, Lawrence, they asked me to be a godfather. And I said, I'm honored to do it, but I'm such a terrible godfather, I never know what to do. You know, you take God seriously. And Sam said, well, I'll give you an assignment. Every year at the anniversary of his baptism, you're to write commending a virtue. So I did that for 15 years, and it wasn't intended to be a book, but after 5 or 6 years, it was clearly becoming one. And so I recommend that because in the book, I try to suggest how virtues are not something one goes about trying to acquire, but rather they ride on the back of our practices that create habits and dispositions that give us the virtues that we hardly know how to name. For example, I start with kindness, and I suggest, because children are cruel, and I call attention to how Laurie is learning how to pet his dog, and that through the petting of the dog, you learn a certain kind of kindness that can be generalized to other modes of life. In this current pandemic, it seems to me, first and foremost is patience. And patience is a very hard and difficult virtue for me. It's one of the central virtues, I think, for Christians, because we are an eschatological people that live with a vigorous hope, but such hope can oftentimes lead to cynicism without this being schooled by patience. So it seems to me we're being schooled by patience right now in a manner that's calling into question the progressivist views of human activity that's so prevalent in Western societies. So the kind of fundamental modes of behavior that we have to undertake to not infect one another can be seen as embodiment of the virtue of patience. So that's one example.
Okay. No, I appreciate that. Professor, this is not a very fun question to ask early on, but I know that we, when we think of how we imitate other people and how we grow in our walk with Christ, one thing that you've often done is almost in the Catholic move, elevated saints, in the sense of we can look at people worth imitating. That's your Aristotelian virtue ethics, I guess. And somebody who was very famous, who's got a big following.
Ben Hay.
You can't hear me?
I said, no, I can hear you there. I think I just wondered if you were going to mention Jean Benier.
Yeah.
Challenge of his life.
Mm.
Was that coming?
Yeah, it was.
I thought it was, and it is nothing but a profound pathos. He was paradigmatic for me. It's not clear that any of us know what a Christian looks like today, but I thought Jean Benier certainly looked like what a Christian should be. And to know that he had this other side, which I found, as the details came out, disgusting. I mean, the kind of piety that surrounded those kinds of sexual modes of behavior, I just thought it's disgusting. And I worried how a person of such deep insight could have negotiated that, what seemed to me, unbelievable contradiction in his life. I think there was a holiness to him that in some ways probably allowed the other stuff to happen. And that tells us that there are deep limits to holiness. It really took me back. And I mean, the same is true of one of my other deep influences, John Howard Yoder.
Yoder, yeah.
Yeah, was, I think, in some ways, Yoder's behavior may have been even worse.
Mm-hmm. Well, Professor, I'm again sorry to ask that question, but I think to follow up on that is we are trying though to say that there's a lot of things that we can learn from the life of Vanier, and I think what we are trying to make sense is this, and this is Skolk's question: can we still engage his work? Can we perhaps even advocate his work? How do we make sense of that? Even Yoda himself, I mean, The Politics of Jesus is such a seminal work.
Absolutely.
And in our cancel culture, it seems like we are guilty by association. But yet I think we're trying to make sense. Can we still use these guys in a qualified way?
I certainly hope so. I have some of my former graduate students who are Mennonites have decided that they're not going to use any of John's work in their undergraduate teaching. I appreciate that. It seems to me to be a peculiar challenge within the Mennonite world. I'm an Aristotelian. I think there is a close connection between what we think and who we are. And I don't want to separate thought from character. But it's my hope that with appropriate contextualization, we can continue to read The Politics of Jesus. We can continue to read Nevertheless. We can continue to read Community and Growth, Jean Benier's early book, which I think says everything he had to say over his lifetime. I think those remain books that it's hard to live without.
Mm. Thank you for that, Professor. To maybe just take a shift, this is my question. I picked up your work in search of a political home, if that makes sense. So we sort of caught up between this binary. I know it doesn't mean much these days, but let's say left wing and right wing, and it's quite safe in both those camps. You know, they tell you exactly what to believe, and I picked up your literature in the hope of finding a political home, and if anything, you've just confused me more, but in a good way, I should add. So I guess my question is, how do you think should Christians relate to this particular binary of, let's say, free market capitalism or socialism, and all the other ideas that come with it? Because it's very tempting to try and fit in one of those categories.
Well, I'll give you my standard answer, the way porcupines screw very carefully. There's no knockdown answer to that. Let me recommend Kevin Hartigan's new book, Christian Ethics in a Post-Liberal Time. It's terrific, as is, I think, Milbank and Adrian Papp's book, Politics of Virtue, is also very, very good in that way. The problem, of course, is the decision to try to be an alternative to the market or to the state means that you become a victim of the market or the state. And you reproduce it because it's to be against it. It makes you part of it. How we can negotiate those alternatives is, as far as I can see, a constant challenge to the imagination. And the imagination has to be real people. I'm in America, the movement that was begun by a man named Saul Alinsky called the Industrial Areas Foundation, in which he wants to create community at the ground level through locating people's real needs. I mean, for example, he was organizing Southside Chicago, which was very, very poor area. And the grocery prices in Southside Chicago were jacked up because it was thought that it was hard to make. You had to charge more because there was so much shoplifting. So he came and asked the people of South Chicago, what is it you want? And they said, better grocery stores. Now, rather than picketing the grocery stores in Southside Chicago, he went to the western side of Chicago where rich folks live, including those that own the grocery store, and picketed their homes. This was unanticipated. And so the very strategy created a kind of community, and that made cooperation possible between people that didn't know cooperation was possible. And though, I mean, those kind of imaginative moves are, I think, what you seek, and you seek it at people's real needs, their immediate needs. I mean, you can cry justice all you want, but it's very hard to specify what you mean by that. It's good to be able to locate the concrete alternative.
Mm. Thank you for that, Professor. I'm still reeling from the porcupine image, unfortunately. Another question that comes from Torsten Malbach. He just asked the question that you've often said, and I'm sorry if these questions do not necessarily follow in each other. This is just the nature of our event. He asked the question, you say that the church should just be the church. In other words, it shouldn't try to make...
The first task of the church is to be the church and not to make the world more just. Right.
Okay. So maybe his question is this: how would you define church, and how would you define world? Where's the boundary?
I don't define anything. Definitions are the destruction of clear thinking. I talk about descriptions. The fundamental distinction between church and world, of course, comes from the Gospel of John. And it it's a way of making clear that you don't have a world until you have a church, because the alternative needs to be present. And that sense, again, we're an eschatological people, what you mean by church and what you mean by world will be constantly renegotiating each. And as they're renegotiated, the challenges that the church brings to the world will also be different. The church world duality, and it's not a dualism, it's a duality. That's a Yoder distinction. That the church world duality is what is more determinative, I think, than law, gospel, nature, grace, and so on. And it's a way of suggesting that as Christians, we are part of a fundamental historical reality that is a movement across time that is shaped by the life of Christ. So church is those people able to confess their failings exactly in the light of their worship of a crucified God.
Thank you. And then, Professor, the last question before we open it up for the other guys on Zoom is this question from Herman. He asks, what will theologians of the future think were the main insights and errors of Western Christianity today? I think he says Western because he doesn't assume that you're going to talk necessarily for African or Eastern Christianity. So what will theologians of the future think were the main insights and or errors of Western Christianity today?
The fundamental insight, I think, is the Christian discovery of the dignity of every human being. And that comes from the recognition that those who lack what is normally seen as normal intelligence are human beings, and they are capable of being God's children. Mm-hmm. I think that also schooled a sense that it is a terror to have other human beings dominated, and therefore we seek their company in a way that we can enjoy one another. The worst thing about Western Christendom is our idealism has meant we are terrible killers, because we think that it is a good thing to take the life of those who are not like us. So it is the violence that we've underwritten in the name of the good that I think we will
Major Aaron.
Be rightly judged for.
Thank you. So what we're going to do now, I see that there are a few questions in the Zoom chat that I can maybe just read. Okay. But we are not a lot. So if you guys want to unmute yourself, maybe just put up your hand and then you can unmute yourself and ask a question directly to Professor Havervas. But in the meantime, Jaco, I can just read your question, I guess. So he asked the question, even though the situation in our world is still unfolding and we are still grappling with the effects thereof, are you willing to share some shifts, invitations you are noticing in our world that you think we should take note of, and possibly some suggestions you would offer? Does that give you enough?
China's real. I mean, what is happening in the Far East, we haven't yet figured out how to respond to at all, or what it would mean to live in a world in which China and India, Indonesia, are, quote, lead countries, and what it means for Christians to exist in social orders that that are not formed by past Christian habits. So I think that we're entering a new world in that way, and I'm going to be long dead before any kind of consistent development is in place.
But if I understand your work correctly, Professor Havervas, you will see this as a promising invitation.
Oh, because, absolutely. Oh, it's very promising.
Yeah. Because we will be without power, I guess.
Well, we will have the power of not being responsible for the world. One more free the imagination to do extraordinary things.
Thanks, Jaco. So if you guys have any questions, just unmute yourself, and then if we can just try and keep the questions as concise as possible, then we can hear as much.
All you guys, by the way, Reformed, how the Reformed tradition?
So absolutely a mixture, Professor Havervas. So I think a lot of the guys here are Reformed, or broadly Reformed at least. But I know a lot of the guys also flirt with Methodism. Louise here, I know she's flirting with Catholicism. So it is a broad mix. I'm not sure if that helps you at all.
That's I'm glad to know. There's a little diversity there, though. Being a Methodist doesn't help you much.
If you guys have any questions, then you can just unmute yourself, put up your hand, unmute yourself, and then just ask Professor Habermas directly.
Okay. Hey, what do y'all do? Pastors or?
Professor Habermas, this was not our agreement. We suggested we ask the questions. You don't ask us the questions. but no, what I can tell you is that we are we're part of a sort of three different movements. The one is called Beter Eindes, which is an attempt to get an imagination and to foster reconciliation in South Africa and fight for justice as well, whatever those things mean. But we try to develop an imagination for that. And then Dialoog is a small church community, and Ratio Christi, they're also a ministry, pretty active here in South Africa. And then you've got guys who are pastors over here, and I guess everybody who knows something about Stanley Habermas joins in. So I don't think we're that uniform. A question that I'm going to ask again. This comes from Tom. Is this question within growing discontent and mistrust in the state as an organ for relief? I guess social relief. What should the church's response be?
I don't know that you can answer that question in principle, because if you stay at the concrete level, it will differ from one context to the other. I suppose I think that you care for the widow, you feed the hungry in ways that you can. I think you try to show in what ways nonviolent social change is possible. And you try to be wise as serpents, as a matter of fact. The first task of the church is not to make the world more just, but to make the world the world. It means that at least Christians could be pointed to and say, people would say, they're very weird. They don't kill one another. And those are the kinds of behaviors that I think are significant for what it means to be Christians in the world in which the authority of state power is increasingly under question. I mean, when you have a Donald Trump as president, the state has become a satire to itself, and it's not quite clear what the future will be in that regard.
Perhaps, Professor, as absolute spectators to American politics, something that I've definitely been baffled about is how it is possible for evangelical Christianity to just blindly align with the Republican Party or Trump in general. Not that I'm saying that they should align with the Democrats necessarily, but it's just a very odd wedding, especially with Donald Trump. That doesn't make sense. Is there something that we're missing?
Evangelicalism in America, first of all, is, I always say it's such a deficient form of Christianity, because they evangelicals think they have a relationship with God, which they go to church to have expressed. The place of the church as an alternative community to the kind of state power is just not in their game. So evangelicals have always been nationalistic in America, and that's certainly continuing. The issue, of course, that they think it all turns on is abortion, and they think that Donald Trump will finally get to appoint Supreme Court justices to the point that they can overturn Roe versus Wade. My hunch is even if Justice Ginsburg dies and he gets to appoint one more, they still won't overturn Roe versus Wade. I'm very sympathetic with their anti-abortion stance, mm-hmm. but I think it's to think that you support Donald Trump for that it is a deep mistake. I think you should never overlook also, I mean, evangelicals in America were the lower middle classes. They've made money. They've become Republicans. that's part of the movement on the evangelical side too.
Yeah, the contradiction is just so strange. I mean, I'm also sympathetic towards the anti-abortion rhetoric, but then on this in the same party, they are very passionate about guns or the death penalty. So it's some just a strange,
right?
Yeah, I guess it's just a strange mix.
Well, I mean, they're so predominant in the South, and to be raised in the South means you were raised with a gun.
Sure. Well, you turned out okay, Professor, so maybe it has its benefits. Louise, you wanted to ask a question. Just unmute yourself real quick.
Louise is still here.
Can you hear me?
Yep. Yes, I can hear you.
Bye. Oh, splendid. How do you do, Professor? Pleased to meet you. Shall I add video as well? Or?
Just ask the question, Louise, you're fine.
Yeah, cool. Okay. Now, my background is philosophy, and I just want to ask, don't worry, Yuan, a question where philosophy and theology seem to overlap. There seems to be a shift in philosophy in particular to turn to ethics or morality as a kind of last resort thing, particularly if you look at the deconstructive tradition. And it's also in liberal theology that you seem to find a kind of fallback upon morality or the good life. Isn't there a danger in contemporary academic Christianity of the good life or the social gospel becoming a kind of substitute for the faith?
I'm interested in your characterization of the developments within philosophical work. I'm a person that's been deeply influenced by the developments from Wittgenstein through Anscombe to Cora Diamond. And I think the kind of reflection that I should mention Iris Murdoch too.
Yes.
The kind of reflection that they have developed in terms of giving us an appreciation of what Cora Diamond calls the difficulties of life is very important. As far as something like the social gospel, supporting a view of the good life. Depends on what, how they understand the view of the good life. I, of course, as an Aristotelian, I think that we should want to live in a manner that our lives can be described as eudaimonistic, that is, a certain sense of being able to look back over one's life and call it good is something that we should all want. But then the question is what kind of life that is that you're able to call good? And it's a life in which surely I'm able to accept forgiveness for the wrongs that I clearly have done, because it's not able to live life without the creation of such wrongs. So, and we have to learn to accept forgiveness. I mean, if you think, for example, in America, and it's not the truth. The Truth Commission in South Africa, it was a remarkable development, Truth and Reconciliation. But if you think, for example, what does it mean to be raised as I was raised, to live in a world in which African Americans were automatically assumed as inferior and you had dominance over them? How do you accept forgiveness for what is clearly wrong and know how to go on? I mean, how do you, as part of the good life, recognize there are certain things that are so wrong, there's nothing you can do to make them right other than to be forgiven and to know how to go on from that being that kind of forgiveness? I mean, those are the kinds of considerations about what makes a good life, that I think isn't about the qualification of our lives as Christians, as followers of Christ. So the good life is not a bad phrase to name the kind of lives we should want to live.
Maybe to add to that, Professor, this is a very unfair question, but how do you think white South Africans, given our very broken and sad history, how do we live the good life now in 2020?
I really can't. I can't. It would be arrogant for me to tell South Africans how I think South Africans ought to live, because I don't know you. And knowing one another is important. I think that the Truth and Reconciliation Commission, which Father Tutu, of course, had such a hand in, wouldn't have been possible if you people hadn't been Dutch Christians. I mean, you got stuck with enough Christianity to make the Truth and Reconciliation process possible. And because there's no way, I mean, of course, what people outside South Africa fail to oftentimes remember is it was the British. The British made the Boer such killers. And but the Boers remained Dutch Calvinists enough to know that killing was wrong and that apartheid was wrong. It was part of the bad conscience of the Dutch, and that was that was a gift God gave you, and you can build on it.
Yeah, I realize it's an unfair question, but I couldn't help myself. Another unfair question comes from Simon Brace. First of all, he just wants to add that Pentecostalism, there are a few Pentecostals on this feed as well, and in his words, there are a few wild-eyed charismatics here in Potchefstroom as well, so don't exclude them. His question is this: what political philosophy and economic theory would be most commensurate with the Christian church in Africa in a post-colonial, post-modern world?
I have no idea.
I said it, don't say.
I have no idea.
Yeah. Are there any questions that are a little bit more becoming and less unfair?
There's one from Herman Cartsons as well, if you can read that.
Oh, yeah, sure. I see it now. Herman asks, do you have any recommendations of books, non-fiction, but especially novels, which can aid us in developing our morals and social imaginations as Christians?
Novels.
Well, non-fiction and novels. You already mentioned Milbank and I think Kevin Hardington, but if you have anything to add to that.
I think reading MacIntyre is really very important. Not just after virtue, but who's justice, which rationality, and three Bible versions are very important, as is, it's the book after Three Rival Versions, and I'm just blocking on the title. His most recent book, Ethics and the Conflicts of Modernity, is an extremely important book.
So is that MacIntyre as well?
Absolutely, MacIntyre. They're all MacIntyre.
Okay.
I think Milbank's Theology and Social Theory is a very important book. As far as novels, again, I'm blocking her name, but Gilead.
Is a
beautiful book. There's a trilogy. Gilead, Home, and I'm forgetting the title of the third, but they're a wonderful read of small town America and Iowa, and the significance of the civil rights and civil war struggles on lives there. Of course, I'm a big fan of Trollope.
A big fan of who?
Trollope.
Well,
Trollope, yeah, Anthony Trollope, which English class society may seem a far way from the kind of challenges we face, but Trollope was a great student of character. And character is everything.
Okay. Professor, here's another question, and I'm curious to know what you're going to do with it. Daniel asks, what is the biggest threat to Christianity on a global level?
The biggest threat, I think, is the fear by Christians that what we believe is not true. The biggest fear is by Christians that what we believe is not true, and therefore the joy that should characterize our lives is absent.
Sure. Something that I found very interesting, a quote from your book, Professor, is this line that I just want you to maybe unpack as we're starting to close. Unfortunately, an accommodationist church so intent on running errands for the world is giving the world less and less in which to disbelieve.
Yeah, that's a line from McIntyre. And McIntyre, the religious significance of atheism that he's talking about Bultmann and Tillich, and says these theologians are giving the world and giving atheists less and less of which to disbelieve, right? I think that's true.
Okay, but try and unpack it a little bit.
Well, it's a way of calling attention to the modernist theological project to let Christians think that they're Christians by thinking that there are some essentials that they can believe, God or something, justice, that there are essentials they can believe, but they don't have to believe all the other stuff like the virgin birth or something like that. Always, Protestant liberals approach the faith with the kind of question, how much of this stuff do I have to believe and still consider myself a Christian? I love living around Roman Catholics who, at least many of them, I learned, approach the faith with the attitude, look at all this extraordinary stuff I get to believe. I think that is a very constructive way to go.
Wow. Yeah, I mean, a lot of the guys actually on this, I think on this broadcast, we consider themselves broadly interested or actively doing Christian apologetics. And that is trying to make the faith intelligible to a world that doesn't believe it. And you've got some nuanced criticism on that.
Yes.
Maybe elaborate.
Well, I have a book called Without Apology. It's a book of sermons that, apologetics has always been part of the Christian theological discipline. The question is how much do you give to the person to who you're trying to make the apology to, in terms of setting the criteria for what counts and doesn't count. I tend to think, Karl Barth's language, the best apologetics is a beautiful dogmatics, and that's what I've tried to do.
But you've also made a big point of when we try to do that, we try to play this Enlightenment game. We try to play by their rules, but we shouldn't be bullied into that.
Oh, you lose. Yeah, my kind of crude way of putting it is modernity is the time that it was thought the project was to create people who believed they should have no story except the story they chose when they had no story. In America, we call that freedom. And so we try to produce young people to make up their own minds and so on. The only problem with you should have no story except the story you chose when you had no story is that's a story you did not choose. So modernity names the time in which people become fated to be free. And the Christian alternative is we are storied. We are not making up the story. we are creatures of a good God who has made us part of the promise to Israel through the life, death, and resurrection of Christ, so that we can live in a world in peace in order to be witnesses to the fact that we are not alone, but that we are creation. We are God's good creation. So that's my way of putting it.
Well, it's a beautiful way of putting it. I don't think we can end on a better note than that, Professor. So thank you again for that.
Does anyone know, by the way, before we finish, how's Peter's story? Does anyone know Peter's story? He was the Methodist bishop during apartheid.
Isn't he the guy who got his limbs blown off by the apartheid? I've got something to say.
No. He was head of the Council of Churches during apartheid. And then...
Yes, Yaku, he's got something to say, Professor.
Yeah.
His son is heading up the Methodist Church in Green Market Square in Cape Town. He's doing amazing work with refugees at this stage. Peter has had a—I don't know what's the English word for stroke. Peter had a stroke 18 months ago. He's since recovered extremely well. He's still doing sermons at his son's church. You will find some of his sermons on the church's website on Central Methodist Mission in Cape Town. He's still active in conferences, academics, and he just brought out last year was a book of his life, his autobiography.
Oh, has he done that? Yeah. Well, I must read it.
Yes. I forgot the name now. But if you Google it, you will find it. And it's an account of his life from when he was born until he was head of the Methodist Church in Southern Africa and with the South African Council of Churches. So he's doing very well.
Oh, well, thank you. If anyone bumps into him, please give him my regards. He is an extraordinarily wonderful, great man.
Thank you, sir.
Excellent. Professor, thank you. Thank you so much. I know this is not necessarily your intention, but definitely part of what we're trying to do is we try to imitate people who we think can make us better disciples of Jesus. And at least through your literature, you've really helped a lot of us to try and do that. So thank you again so much for your work and for humbling us with your presence. It looks like Skolk's got a question.
I don't know if it's appropriate on Zoom and speaking like this, but I would give a request that Professor closes our Zoom, not just by saying goodbye, but closing with a prayer for us, if you would be willing to do that.
Shall I?
Please.
May we pray. Mm-hmm. Lord of time, through your Son, you have grafted us into the people of Israel, making us friends with those who frighten us and friends of one another. Help us be brothers and sisters across time and space, so that we might learn never to kill. We ask you for this great gift in the name of your Son, Jesus Christ. Amen.
Professor Habermas, thank you so much.
You're very welcome.
Okay, that concludes the end of our session. You guys are welcome to...